The scripture reading this morning, for those following along, is taken from the Gospel according to Matthew, chapter 27, reading from verses 57 to chapter 28, verse 20. It is taken from the NIV, New International Version. As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance of the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. The next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days, I will rise again.' So give order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people he has been raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first." "Take a guard," Pilate answered. "Go, make the tomb as secure as you know how." So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting a guard. After the Sabbath, at dawn, in the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were as white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples, 'He has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you.'" So the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid, yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly, Jesus met them. "Greetings," he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me." While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say, 'His disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep.' If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks so much, Bill. I just sprung that on Bill like 10 minutes ago as well, so that was... It's pretty awesome. It's really great to be here today, and really great to be able to celebrate Jesus' resurrection and share. And we're going to look at that story and that passage today. And if I haven't met you before, my name's Tim, and I'd love to meet you as well at some point. And we've been going through this book of the Bible called Matthew for quite a while, and. And that was the end of it. Actually, that's the final chapter. We're looking at the end of chapter 27 and the final chapter 28, which is the end, but it's also the beginning of something totally new. And as we've been celebrating today, today is just so much about joy. But the cool thing about it is it's not about a joy that is forced. And today is not at all about hype. And it's not all about... at all about trying to have pressure for something to happen. Because the people who experienced this joy were totally surprised. Because what has just gone on before the resurrection is Jesus' crucifixion that we've been looking at. And it's just been such an intense 24 hours. We've been looking at this over a few weeks, but you might remember a while ago we looked at Jesus' night with his disciples where he shared the Passover meal. That was Thursday night, he shares that meal. They go to the garden when he prays. He's betrayed. He's arrested. He has a trial before the Jewish courts. He has a trial before the Roman court. And then Friday morning is crucified, is on the cross for 6 hours, and then quickly is rushed to be buried before the Sabbath comes. So all of that in like 24 hours. It's so intense and so quick. And is so, actually, the whole scene is so full of grief and difficulty. But into that grim reality of death, God brings life and joy and freedom in such a surprising but beautiful way. So let me just pray, and then we've got a lot to cover, but we'll try and go pretty quick through this passage today. Jesus, thank you that you are alive and with us, and just thank you for what today means. And we just ask, God, that you would fill us with its truth and with the reality of your presence. Fill us with joy and hope and life. And God, would that multiply all around into our communities, into our neighborhoods, into the world. This message spread in your name, Jesus. Amen. So this is the sort of the end of that day, which is the Friday. As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he'd cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. So obviously we've gone through this whole story of Jesus' crucifixion, the mocking, the shame, his death, and then the story shifts to his burial, which is actually really, really important because it shows two things, that Jesus actually died, because some people have said that, well, maybe he didn't actually really die, but it's clear he died, And his body was accounted for. It was buried somewhere that was known. It was witnessed by people. And this is a strange way. This is not obviously how we bury people today, but this was a normal thing to wrap the body in cloth, to place it in a tomb. And that was a normal thing, but it actually wasn't a normal thing for someone who'd been crucified. If someone was crucified, they would actually just be left there, or they'd be thrown in a mass grave or something like that. But Jesus' body is cared for by his disciples, which is so important because the body is really key to this story. But this would have just been, obviously we're talking about the resurrection, but at the same time we have to just recognize what these women and these disciples would have been experiencing just before it, which is like a huge amount of grief, confusion, fear. They're caring for Jesus' body, but it's rushed burial. They don't get to anoint his body. They don't have time. But interestingly, Jesus had previously said when the woman poured perfume on his body a few days before that that was when he was being anointed in preparation. But this is important that Jesus' body is cared for, but it's in this context of fear and grief and really of hopelessness. The disciples are not looking to a resurrection. They're actually, most of the disciples are not even there. There's this man that God works through, Joseph, comes and then he leaves and the women are there and that's it. But Jesus' body is not just cared for, it's also the source of concern for the authorities, because the authorities have been trying to silence Jesus, and they have. They've killed him, they've humiliated him, but then even still afraid that maybe the disciples could still be a threat. And there's this controversy that could arise to do with the body. So they recognize and believe they have to really contain the body. It says this in verse 62. The next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come, steal the body, and tell people that he'd been raised from the dead, and this last deception will be worse than the first." "Take a guard," Pilate said. "Go make the tomb as secure as you know how." So they went and made the tomb secure, putting a seal on the stone and posting a guard. This is so interesting. And again, the whole story of Jesus' death and resurrection is just filled with irony, because the disciples are not thinking about the resurrection. Jesus' enemies are thinking about the resurrection. Jesus' disciples have forgotten that he said that he would rise. Jesus' enemies recognize that he said he was going to rise. And they're maybe even nervous that maybe he will, but they say that they're nervous that the disciples are going to steal the body and make up this lie. But that's just not the case. That's not at all where the disciples are at. But where this leads to is a situation where Jesus doesn't just die. He's also buried, and his tomb is surrounded and sealed. And really, for his followers, all the joy is gone. He's not just that he died, but the idea that when someone dies, right, it's almost made more final when they're buried. It's like he's actually buried. And it's not just that he's buried, but the tomb is surrounded by his enemies. This looks like a hopeless situation for Jesus' followers, that it seems like death has won. It seems like this was too good to be true. It seems like the religious leaders actually have the power and the final word. There's care given to Jesus' body, but it's not really in hope that something will happen. It's just a few women who have a sense of loyalty toward him who God uses to do that. And again, it's important because it shows that Jesus really died, but it's also interesting because what this actually does is set the scene for what's going to come. It's almost like a puzzle that's just coming together, that the body is in the tomb, and even though that's being sealed and opposed and there's a sense of the enemy trying to lock up the joy and lock up the hope, it's actually the fact that it's surrounded by guards is actually going to make when Jesus is risen even more convincing, because it's been witnessed by guards. God is setting the scene for what will happen next, and like he's been doing through the cross, he will even use the opposition for his purposes. They're guarding the tomb, and that will actually make it more legitimate that Jesus is actually risen. So this is where we can posture ourselves as we come to the resurrection, not trying to make something happen or force something, but actually recognizing the situation seems hopeless, but actually God is at work even in that. We're just going to take some time again as we go through today just to be open to God and to pray and to reflect. So I just have a question for you about what that might like even to look like today or personally, just God's work in this situation. Question just to ponder for a moment. If God is at work setting the scene in Jesus' death and burial, how might he be at work in my life when the joy is gone and the things that I'd hoped in now seem dead and buried? Just give you a moment to consider that. As we said on Friday, how we can be honest with God about our questions and our doubts, and we can be honest when we're not experiencing joy, but even recognize that God could be at work in that, actually doing something. And that seems to be what's happening here. But most of the disciples are gone. They've left. They're hopeless. The joy is gone. It's locked up. It's sealed. The women will go to the tomb again, not really expecting anything, but just to give care to Jesus' body. But into that scene, like no hope, nothing forced, nothing expected, heaven powerfully breaks in and changes everything. It says this in chapter 28. After the Sabbath, at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. Again, this is a scene of death. It's a scene of hopelessness. It's a scene of opposition. But then God comes powerfully and the reality of heaven all of a sudden just enters the scene and just shifts everything in a second. Right? The guards are nothing for this angel. The stone is nothing for this angel. There's no problem at all. But this scene is so otherworldly, right? All of a sudden, there's an angel. And we haven't seen angels in this story since we talked. They were the angels at Jesus' birth that witnessed his birth. But now there's an angel here just at his resurrection. When we read something like this, it sort of seems like crazy and weird, like angels and earthquakes and like scary and crazy. But what's so crazy about this passage is that the angel actually acts really normal. The angel actually makes this all sound quite normal, if you can think of it to be normal, or maybe not so much normal, but just human and relatable, because the angel doesn't seek to make them afraid. And in fact, the angel said to the woman, "Do not be afraid, for I know you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples, he has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you." The angel freaks the guards out, which and clearly scares the women, but doesn't intend to. The first words are, "Don't be afraid. Like, there's nothing to be afraid of. You're looking for Jesus. Sorry, he's not here. Like, he's alive. And just go tell people." Like they just present it like, "Oh, okay. Like, he's just alive." Like, they go to find his body. Like, his body's in the tomb. They saw it, and they said, no, the body's not here. You can go and look. The body's gone." Like they really present it as just something that's just happened. God has just come and shifted it. It's the strangest event to ever happen because people don't rise from the dead. But they talk about it like it's a given. This is what Jesus said he was going to do. Like, so he did it. Like, it's presented like that. They can go and investigate it. They can go and look in the tomb and see the body is gone. So then they go, it says in verse 8, and hurried away from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy. This is scary. This breaks all their categories. Yet now something's happening that's filling them with joy. They're not forcing something, they're not hyping something, but they're being filled. And they ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly, Jesus met them. "Greetings," he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me. Again, heaven breaks in again, this time with Jesus. They actually see his body. They see him raised from the dead in bodily form. And again, this is the strangest thing. This doesn't happen. This makes no sense, but it's actually presented as just actually making sense, that Jesus is just there. And again, Jesus is quite normal. He's not like a zombie. He's not like a ghost. He's not like just a spiritual being. He's a physical person. He's a human. And he really does the most human thing. And this is, just studying this passage, this is what's been getting me the most. It's like, what's the first thing Jesus says to them when he rises from the dead? We read it there, it says, greetings. But one commentator said, like, the better translation for us into our language, our modern day language, is hi. Jesus rises from the dead, he appears to them and says, hi. And it's so human. It's so otherworldly, like he's alive, and it's so human. Jesus just presents this as like normal. This is what he said. Dale Bruno, one commentator, says it this way: the word's closest modern equivalent, I think, but because it's closest to what we most often say in meeting, is the extremely simple hi. This earthiness is wonderful. We ask ourselves, what will be the first words of the risen Lord? The answer is hi. While hi is no great message from the other side, it is so human that it almost tells us enough. It tells us that after the resurrection, Jesus may be much more, but he is nothing less than the real human being he was before his death. It tells us that Jesus is still Jesus, that he is still friendly and human with us. And there's something that combines in that humanness of the... This is not some freaky spiritual like thing that we've got to force. It's like, no, he's just there. He's alive. And he just greets them. And they touch him. And they experience him. And he's really alive. And there's no reason to fear now. There's great reason for joy because the tomb is empty and Jesus is alive. Again, this is not... The resurrection of Jesus is not a super spiritual story about Jesus just living on in the memory of his followers or just being like in heaven somewhere far, far away. Like the story is that his body was actually buried and then people couldn't find it. It disappeared and then they saw him as a real human alive from the dead. Eyewitnesses saw him. So the invitation and the hope of the resurrection is actually that the hope is not that we're going to escape the physical world one day and move to like a spiritual existence that's superior, that God actually values the physical world and heaven actually comes into the physical world and makes it new. God breaks in, and this is presented as a historical fact that the body was gone, that Jesus is alive. And the command in response to this, again, is to not be afraid, because death is potentially the most scary thing. And Jesus says, just don't be afraid, because it's okay. Like, he's gone through it. And God can be scary, and the idea of resurrection can be scary. But he says, no, don't be afraid. Like, he's alive. The tomb is empty. And ultimately, Jesus is trustworthy. He said this is what he would do. He would go to the cross. He would be buried. He would rise again. So he does. He just does what he said he would do. So let's take a moment again. And I think the invitation is to experience the joy of the risen Jesus by actually letting this become more personal to ourselves. So just have this question for a moment. What is it like to imagine yourself meeting the risen Jesus, touching his physical body, and hearing him say hi in your name? Don't be afraid. And can you give yourself permission to enter the joy of that good news? Because it seems clear that the fear blocks this. That's why they keep saying, don't be afraid, because fear makes it too hard to actually believe. Don't be afraid, but let the joy come. Let's take a moment. So they meet Jesus again. They weren't expecting to. They weren't trying to. They were not. This is a surprise, and this totally changes everything. It gets rid of the fear, and it fills them with this joy. And now there's a message to spread. And the women are told first to go tell the disciples. But this is what the authorities were afraid of, that this message would get out that Jesus is risen and that the disciples would make it up. And the disciples are not thinking about it, but then it actually happens. And now the disciples are starting to spread it. And so there's a need to contain this message, because this message is getting spread that Jesus is alive, and they were trying to stop Jesus. And now this message is going out, but it cannot be stopped. It says this in verse 11. While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed, and this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. There is an attempt to contain the message, to change the narrative so that the truth about Jesus' resurrection doesn't spread. And they were accusing the disciples of lying about it, but instead they decide to spread a lie to cover it up. But the easiest way to shut this whole thing down would simply be to show Jesus' body, to present the body. Like, he can't be alive because here he is. We have the tomb. But that's the one thing they can't do, because the body's gone. And what's so interesting is the false narrative presumes that the body is gone. Like, nobody has claimed to find the body. That the fact that the tomb is empty is actually confirmed here by Jesus' enemies. They are in agreement of that, but there needs to be an alternate explanation to cover up the truth that he rose. So there's this attempt to, and it's kind of encouraging, because the attempt to contain it is just so weak and doesn't even make sense. It actually gives further confirmation that, well, this probably actually happened, because the idea that his disciples stole the body does not make any sense. Again, we know the disciples were afraid, were cowards, they'd run away, they were hiding, they're not going to go and steal a body in the face of Roman soldiers and make up this. And if they did, they would be presenting a lie. They would know it's a lie. And there's no reason for them to do that, because the only thing that happened to them by announcing this message is that they got persecuted and killed for it. There was no incentive to die for a lie. And this story is contradictory. It makes no sense, because the guards are told to tell people that while we were asleep, the disciples stole the body. It's like, how do you know that if you were asleep? Like, it's just a contradictory reason. It doesn't actually make any sense, but it's just, there has to be a counter narrative, and there's an attempt to contain the message, but actually the message can't be contained. Jesus has won. He's such a powerful force that even though they kill him, they can't keep him down. Even though they try and contain the message, they can't stop it from spreading. And now it's going to spread everywhere. It's unleashed. We see this in verse 16. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." This is what Jesus had said. Go to Galilee and the disciples will see me. And they reunite. And this is like where most of Jesus' ministry happened. And he's with his friends and his followers. They are reunited. And there's even an honesty about the presence of doubts in the midst of this, because it's so strange. But then at the same time, it's like, well, they're just with Jesus again. This is what they were always doing. And it's the same Jesus who's now in charge of everything. Heaven and earth have come together and he's in charge of it all. He has all authority and now he calls all people, but he also promises that he will always be with us, which will happen when he sends the Spirit, when he ascends. And basically now this joyful message explodes and spreads all over the world. And the joy that these first believers experienced by seeing Jesus alive cannot be contained. And what really the principle is that news of the resurrection, the joy of the resurrection just naturally flows into mission. It's good news that is to be spread. It goes out, and this happened. And again, one of the greatest evidences that Jesus really rose from the dead is simply just the existence of the church, particularly the early church, because these are not smart, influential people. They're just presented as fearful people and weak people, but then this community just explodes and they become people who have joy and power and hope and strength. Even in the face of death, they're not worried because they have seen Jesus. And he just says, don't be afraid. Like, there's nothing to be afraid of. And this goes all around the world and goes down all the way through history, 2,000 years to today. And this is where we are, that we have received this message, that we are here because of what happened that day. And now we get to actually be a part of the story. We get to experience the great joy and contribute to the mission and share it and continue to see it spread all around the world and not contained. But sometimes, sadly, that has been presented as a burden or something that we have to be forced to do, to go and tell people and spread the message. But that's not at all how it's presented here. This is presented as effectively an explosion of joy, a news that just cannot be kept still, cannot be hidden. And that's what we're invited into. Leslie Newbegin on this, thought this quote was great. He says this: there has been a long tradition which sees the mission of the church primarily as obedience to a command. Now, Jesus does command it, but the idea is like obligation. It tends to make mission, sharing this good news, a burden rather than a joy, to make it part of the law rather than the gospel. If one looks at the New Testament evidence, one gets another impression. Mission begins with a kind of explosion of joy. The news that the rejected and crucified Jesus is alive is something that cannot possibly be suppressed. It must be told. The mission of the church in the pages of the New Testament is more like the fallout from a vast explosion, a radioactive fallout which is not lethal but life-giving. The point is, we have good news and we get to share it. We get to share it, and we don't have to force ourselves to share it. The thing is just to recognize it's good, and just when you experience something good, you naturally share it. You just have to not hold it and keep it. And sadly, I think sometimes we've put pressure on people to share it, and that actually loses the inner sort of motivation. But actually, we're invited just to experience the joy and enter Jesus' mission. So just, we're almost finished, but I'll give you another moment to just consider that and a question just to think about this morning. Final one. Does sharing in Jesus' mission sound like a joy or a burden? And what could it look like to let the joy of this message spread through my life? Just give you a moment to pray. So we're gonna sing again in a moment, and it's a great opportunity to share the joy together, and then just to be open to God working through us to spread this message. And so Matthew's gospel ends here, but the ending is again really the beginning of the church, the mission, the God's work that's going to go out through the world, and the promise of Jesus' presence. We've been building up to Easter, and then sort of Easter we'll finish obviously at the end of today, but then that's actually a fresh start into sharing this message and celebrating Jesus each day. And as we think about his resurrection, we recognize that one day we will each face our own death like Jesus did, that we will come to, in a sense, the end, but because of this day, we recognize that actually that will just be the beginning of a deeper experience of God and Jesus and his presence. And ultimately, one day he will physically raise us with resurrection bodies that will be with him forever. The hope is, again, not that we just have some ethereal hope of some faraway afterlife, but actually the hope of heaven breaking in, renewing the earth, making all things new, and we get to be with Jesus. So he is risen, which means we don't need to fear. We're invited to see, investigate. If you're not sure if it's true, the invitation is to go and look at the tomb, look at the accounts, look at the claims, seek the truth, and pray that God would open your eyes. And if that's happened to us, the invitation is to share it, to tell others. So today, if you've never actually believed in Jesus, that the invitation is to simply believe that this is true, which means recognize that he is the King. He's come to save us, to rescue us and forgive us, and we can just put our life in his hands and receive his forgiveness and grace. And if you'd like prayer today for anything, if you need a sense of God's joy to be restored particularly, please come forward. There'll be people down the front to pray with you afterwards as well. But otherwise, let's stand together and let's sing and let's celebrate.